Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Schmidt, Judge Hooten, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you and good morning. This is case 823-0430, Faulkner versus City of Minneapolis. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes, and finally, appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. This matter is being live streamed and will also be available tomorrow by audio recording, but our rules do prohibit anyone making a private recording of this, so we ask you to respect that. So with that, I would ask counsel for the appellant, just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please, and you may begin.
May it please the court, I'm Steve Anderson. I'm here on behalf of the petitioner, or the appellant. May I begin?
Yes, please do, Mr. Anderson.
May it please the court, appellant is here today because the trial court improperly ruled that the city is immune from liability. Therefore, no issue of material fact can exist and summary judgment is appropriate. If it's immune, there can't be any facts to be in dispute. Consequently, the appellant respectfully asks this court to properly apply an immunity standard that recognizes ministerial tasks exist even after discretionary decisions are reached, generally to enforce, in this case, the housing code. Recognize the appellant's claim for negligence causing a nuisance against the city of Minneapolis is properly pled within the context of Walsh v. U.S. Bank, 851 Northwest 2nd, 598-602, Minnesota 214. And that determined that when viewed in light most favorable to the appellant, issues of material fact do exist regarding the nature and effectiveness of ministerial tasks taken following the decision to enforce the housing code, thereby rendering summary judgment inapplicable. The appellant's original action included only one claim of negligence, of nuisance. Specifically, the appellant claims that by constantly failing to require Mr. Bratton, who owns the house next door, to comply with city ordinances, the city has created a nuisance impacting plaintiff's property that is injurious to plaintiff's health. And the rest of the paragraph 31 just follows the language of 566. Although labeled as a nuisance, the language constantly failing implies negligence, as I will discuss later. Despite Minneapolis Code Chapter 244, requiring that no one be allowed to live in such non-compliant properties, the building next door to appellant was always full until ultimately the inhabitants fired shots at appellant's house, including the gas meter, made threats that appellant's house would be burned down and ultimately murdered someone in the house.
Mr. Anderson, can I because I think we are familiar with the numerous code violations of the residents next to your client's house. Can I ask you this, and it's a legal issue. Do you agree that the enforcement powers of the DRS director are discretionary?
Yes, Your Honor, certainly. The enforcement powers, the decision to enforce is clearly discretionary.
All right. And inspections are ministerial, or do you agree with that concept as well? That because the code provision indicates the DRS director shall make inspections.
I'm having serious
that.
Your Honor, I had some hearing issues there. Could you?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll speak up. Do you agree that the code also provides that the DRS director shall make inspections? So, and that those inspections are therefore ministerial.
Yeah, because they are. Yes, they're ministerial.
All right. Then. Here, I mean, what is your claim in terms of, what does the official immunity here, doesn't that apply here to any discretionary acts?
The discretionary acts that require that are in fact made as decisions to enforce are. The example that I've used in the past is that doesn't necessarily rule out the existence of ministerial tasks beyond that decision to enforce or the decision to do anything. That ministerial tasks are inherent to any decision-making process. And the example I'll give you is if, in fact, you remand this case back to the trial court, that decision is clearly discretionary. But then lots of other tasks have to happen beyond that that are more ministerial in nature. For example, the clerks will have to make sure that everything is complied with to get the case filed, to get the order online. All those tasks that follow your decision don't appear to be, to the appellant's thinking, appear to be anything but ministerial. They're based upon a clear decision, and there's no discretion involved. They have to do X, Y, and Z.
Well, I guess I'm not following you. I mean, aren't you essentially claiming here that basically the city or the director should have revoked the rental license of this house a long time ago? Is that the essence of your claim?
Not necessarily that they should have revoked it. That the decision to revoke, and in my earlier, stages, what I was going to say, there were, when the shooting occurred, there were 17 additional violations on the books. Then the decision to non-comply was brought in September, of non-compliance in September 2021. We are not saying that was in any way, shape, or form non-discretionary. But after that, it wasn't until March of 2022 that they took action to demolish the house. My claim is that there would be actions that were taken in between those things, those two decisions, that are not ministerial, and that they could, in fact, and we do believe, have caused that delay. And that it repeated itself all the way through. Now, what the court said was, I believe it was the court, or maybe it was the respondent, that this is just typical in a very busy city, that they have tons of these things going on everywhere, and that would be the typical time frame. But we don't know if that's true.
But in to the extent you're arguing it's a time frame issue, isn't when the enforcement action is taken, isn't that discretionary as well?
Yes. The enforcement action is discretionary. The actions that are taken to comply with that and make sure it happens are ministerial.
So am I correct, Mr. Anderson? The city council, what made the final decision to revoke the license? Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
And so are you complaining that between the time it took them for the city council to act, because clearly they could have said no, give them another chance. Is it your complaint that the failure of the city is between the time the city council made the decision to revoke and the time the house was demolished? Is that the essence of your complaint?
Actually, the time that the decision was made to issue the non-compliance and the time it was revoked, yeah. I'm not arguing there weren't discretionary decisions made in between them. I guess what I'm trying to say is that in Gleason, Gleason says, look, it's based on a question of whether or not it's a decision is a conclusion reached after consideration, an act is an act that is done. But in Gleason, it says we have to look at the precise action being taken. And this argument is basically based on Gleason, that identification of the precise government contact at issue, stating that everything done by the city after several hundred violations are recorded as immune, is inconsistent with Gleason, particularly where a discretionary decision enforcement was made. In other words, rounding everything up and saying, oh, that's immune because someone made a decision that was discretionary, someone had to carry it out. Those actions aren't necessarily immune by virtue of being ministerial.
Have you alleged in your complaint any specific administrative or ministerial act that did not take place? That should have taken place?
The complaint itself is concise, perhaps to a fault, but it's very concise. And the attachments are the things that are create the background for the story. And there are testimonials from various people in the neighborhood talking about what has happened and who they've talked to and what hasn't been done. And also all 300 violations are in there. That is where the basic story is told. And that in that context, the ability to determine if any of those actions in fact raise to the level of creating an expectation that would overcome both immunity and some other issues is taken away by the fact that there was dismissed without discovery.
But I mean, in that the city has already revoked the license. I mean, and you're talking about ministerial acts associated with that discretionary act. What specific ministerial act have you complained about in your complaint associated with that discretionary decision to revoke the rental license?
Your Honor, it is based solely on the timeline, and that there isn't a specific act right now that is included in the complaint that could be spoken to as directly as you'd like it to be in the complaint.
I mean, the court can't speculate that there might be something when there's the undisputed fact is the city did revoke the license.
The city revoked the license 15 months after the shooting.
So again, we're talking about the timing. It's a timing issue then that you're complaining about.
Yeah, basically.
And if we determine that timing is a discretionary part of the decision, then wouldn't the official immunity apply here?
Yes, in this case, would be toast. That is true. If you decide that all of the everything that is done in terms of going forward with any decision made in discretion is included in that decision, yes. That's why this is a little different request.
But, Mr. Anderson, it seems to me the heart of what you're asking is that maybe it should be a shooting or, you know, some fast track process depending on the nature of the violation or, you know, the number of violations or how serious the violation is. But, you know, isn't the decision to fast track, you know, a revocation? I mean, it seems to me that's essentially a policy decision. Either they should have a policy or they shouldn't. But how is that something that we can say they should have and therefore they don't get immunity?
Yeah, Your Honor, I was thinking about this all night, that question. And the answer for me is that you cannot obviously create a policy. You can't. But you can recognize that extreme facts as an exception to basically what is current here might create a necessity for a exception to the immunity process. And by simply adding that there might be what we believe is common sense, that every single decision that is discretionary creates a ministerial action somewhere. And what we're really asking for is I don't want to say it's an extension of Gleason, that where there are precise actions that can be taken to enforce, we don't believe those should be immune actions.
Was it 15 minutes from the shooting or 15 months from the shooting to the revocation? What is the 15-month timeline between what and what?
The 15-month timeline was in June and July 2020, the shooting occurred and there were still unresolved violations of the book, including, by the way, failure to reapply for a license. In September of 21, a notice of noncompliance was sent to the home. And on November of 10th, the license was pulled. And on March 18th, the city council took action. So really, it's the 15 months are from the shooting. If you were to add the emergency repair order for from 2019. It's actually closer to 23 months.
And I'm sorry, they were revoked when?
March 18th, 2022. One other thing I might add in there that as you can see, the dates are all COVID dates. And that because there is seriously, you know, we acknowledge that COVID might have had an issue in this whole thing. Certainly did everywhere else.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Is it up? Is my 15 minutes?
I'm afraid it is.
Thank you.
But you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Sauter, you may begin, sir.
May it please the court, Mr. Anderson. I am Gregory Sauter, and I'm Assistant City Attorney representing the city in this matter. Before we get into my introduction, I want to address an issue that really was clarified in the argument beforehand. When it comes down to it, plaintiff is arguing that during the process of a discretionary decision, envelopes weren't stamped, letters weren't addressed, and basic tasks were not done, therefore inappropriately extending the timeline of what's going on here. And those issues about minor ministerial tasks that may or may not be subsumed by the discretionary act were actually dealt with in a line of cases coming out of snowplow immunity. And I would like to direct the court to two cases. One of them is Mielke, M-I-E-L-K-E versus Miller, A-10-1278, 2011 Westlaw, 1236811. And the court in that case was dealing with a snowplow that went through a stop sign, and with an argument that going through the stop sign was a violation of a ministerial duty. And the court said to isolate the obligation to keep proper or to keep proper lookout. To isolate the obligation to keep proper lookout from the other aspects of the protected discretionary snowplow activities would frustrate the very purposes of immunity. Then this court, the Court of Appeals, on June 20th, 2023, and denied by the Supreme Court on August 22nd, 2023, in Steele versus Lefevre, A-22-1714, 2023 Westlaw 407-4021, dealt with a similar issue with a snowplow driver going through a stop sign. When it comes down to it, even if there are ministerial tasks subsumed within the overall discretionary decision, those ministerial tasks are still subject to the immunity. At a certain point, if somebody gets, if a letter sits on a desk for an extra day or week or even month, that does not necessarily change the fundamental discretionary nature of the activity. So in this case, there is no dispute that over 200, I believe it was 267 that were alleged in the complaint, violations were on the property at the time this lawsuit was brought, and that all but 30 of them were thereabouts, and I would defer to the complaint on that, were resolved. There's no dispute and no allegation that any of the inspectors doing the inspections observed a violation but did not write them up. And based on the Ellis case, which is quoted in our briefing, that those activities are ministerial. But what plaintiff really wishes had happened here is the secondary more that would hopefully have pushed Mr. Bratton to get his tenants in line and run a proper property. And though that more are all decisions made by the director or the city council or boards at the city. Let's look at the more that's available to the city under the code. The city could have brought suit seeking enforcement. That's under MCO 244.80. But bringing a lawsuit is a discretionary decision and a policy decision. It could have issued emergency orders. and that's 244.160 in the Minneapolis Code. But that, if it involved the emergency board, as happened in this case in 2019, when the furnace wasn't working, also involves a contested hearing before a board who makes a quasi-judicial decision whether or not an emergency exists, and whether, and in that case, they decided to repair or replace the furnace and to assess the property afterwards. The assessment itself would finally go to the city council. Then,
Council, can I ask a question? Is there ever a time where there's so many violations and so much time has passed that the city would not be immune?
Your Honor, that's not how the code is structured. The code is structured where it gives duties to the owners and occupiers to maintain the structure, and the enforcement is on the city. And if there was, I cannot think of a situation where the city would not be immune unless they did nothing. Because the city, the director has an obligation to conduct inspections. And in this case, there's no dispute that inspections were conducted. And but the decisions of the about the intensity of the inspection, the staffing of those inspections, how many people to hire, what to have the and what to train them on, that is all discretionary to the director and therefore subject to immunity. And that's just not the case we have here. Inspections were done, actions were taken. But going to the code itself, talking about those things, talking about what duties are discretionary, what duties go to the property owners. The equipment and facilities, 244.260, and I'm only going to quote this once because the same language is essentially used in every section of the code, is 244.260, no person shall occupy as owner-occupant or allow another to occupy any dwelling unit or other structure for the purpose of living, sleeping, cooking, or eating therein, which does not comply with the requirements set forth in this article. That is a duty that accrues to the owner. And 244.260 is about equipment and facilities. 244.400 is about lighting and ventilation. 244.490 is about maintenance by the owner. 244.790 is about minimum space for dwelling units. And 244.890, with similar language, is fire protection. When it comes down to it, the city's argument is simple. When Ms. Faulkner, and frankly, the city is sympathetic with Ms. Faulkner's plight and with what happened with the property next to her and what happened to her tenants. But her issue is she wanted more than violations being written up and the code being enforced. She wanted actions like the revocation. And that revocation is fundamentally a discretionary act.
Am I correct? Is it the city council? Are they the only people who can revoke? They have to have a meeting and vote. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. The process goes notice, revocation by the director, but final decision is made by the city council. And that's a quasi-judicial decision, as this court ruled in In Re Con, which is in a 2011 case that's.
And I assume revoking a rental license is different from condemning the building because it's structurally unsound.
Condemnation is another discretionary act to be determined by the director. And then if one actually proceeds to a teardown, that would also be an act of the city council. I don't have the code provisions in front of me to give that to you, Your Honor. I apologize for that.
What if there is this scenario, this hypothesis? The city inspects it and decides that, you know, the building is just uninhabitable. So what happens then? Do they condemn it, or do they revoke the license, or do they issue a order to evacuate? What happens if the building is unstructurally unsafe to live in, what happens? What does the city do then once they've made that determination?
Your Honor, I don't have the citations in front of me, but I believe it happens this way. And that would be a determination would be made by the chief housing official that an emergency is present and the building is unsound, and people would be removed from the building at that point. Further action, such as
presumably that would not take 18 months.
No, that wouldn't take 18 months, but that's so all discretionary.
If it's a condemnation, there is some emergency fast track procedure that's in place.
There is, Your Honor, but it's still discretionary to the decision maker in that case. It is not an automatic. If X amount of violations occur, if the heating system is cut off or whatever it might be, it's not an automatic. It is a discretionary decision where they have to weigh the facts in that case.
Can I follow up on a question that Judge Schmidt put to you? If in fact there's official immunity for any discretionary act, which I think we all agree would include law enforcement or code enforcement, if in fact that is the case, I mean, isn't the setup, I mean, the scheme basically depriving the adjacent homeowners of any remedy?
Well, Your Honor, I think to answer that question, I think I want to look at what how the negligence law works and the public duty doctrine under Craycraft. And the city's duty to inspect is a public duty. It is not a private duty individual here. So even if we didn't have immunity, liability would not accrue. Now, the district court did not rule on this, but we briefed this as an alternate means for this court to rule, because the city's duty is a public. If one looks at the Craycraft case itself, a gas line exploded at Benilde St. Margaret in St. Louis Park. And in that case, the court ruled that the St. Louis Park's duty was a public duty, and the fact that their inspection failed to find something did not create liability for those inspectors. Even if that inspection, getting back into immunity land, was a ministerial duty. The duty, the injury from by a third party to because of the inspection, St. Louis Park's duty in Craycraft to Benilde St. Margaret was to the public, not to Benilde St. Margaret and not to the injured individual. The city's duty here is to the public to inspect and enforce, but not to the individual next door. So, Your Honor, liability would not accrue. So, and that's getting back into talking about the public duty doctrine, going back to discuss those points in the code where the people should act. Equipment and facilities, 244.260, 244.400, 244.490, and so forth. Those are all duties created by the code that go to the landowner or Mr. Bratton, who owned the problem property here. The city's duty is for the city's duty is to run the system, but hold on one second here. If one looks at the entire code, what's the purpose of the code? It's a public purpose. MCO 244.20 states under purpose and policy, quote, "The purpose of the housing maintenance code is to protect the public health, safety, and welfare." That's it. It goes nowhere to say it is to protect the property of owners right next to a problem property. It doesn't mention Ms. Faulkner, and it doesn't create a duty directly to her. So even were immunity to fail in this case, under the public duty doctrine, there still would be no liability accruing. But going back to this, the city's argument is simple, and we believe that the court got it right, and which is there are no allegations that anything that the inspections done, all 260 of them, were failed inspections or negligently done. The allegations are that the city didn't do any more than that. And in that case, that more is subject to discretionary is subject to the discretion of the housing official, the director, and then the city council ultimately. And when one gets into those quasi-judicial decisions, we would challenge even the jurisdiction of this court to hear the those decisions because of the whole quasi-judicial decision analysis. So when it comes down to it, the city does appreciate the challenges that Ms. Faulkner has faced here. And the city did its duty. Perhaps it could have done it more quickly, but it fulfilled its duty. And whether or not a clerk failed to address an envelope or send a letter or something else is irrelevant to your analysis, Your Honor. And that decision from September of 2021 through March of 2022, that decision and that action is protected by official immunity. That's all I have, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Sauter. Mr. Anderson, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a quick couple points. The Craycraft case does, in fact, according to our belief, create an action that would be relevant to the existing case, in that the special duty criteria includes whether or not the city had acted in a way that, in this particular case, that produced some expectations on the part of my client that she relied upon, and that by relying on it, she was damaged. There is that out in about the only out in the public duty aspect. But what you really heard, I think, is that no one really has a chance, given the current state of the immunity rules, to take any action against governments, except in very, very narrow places. And we were trying to create a way to allow my client to bring an action based on immunity not being in place for ministerial acts that would allow her and others to challenge that immunity process more completely in the future. Because of that, we just ask that the case be remanded and sent back to trial court. And that's all I have, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Sauter. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. The matter is submitted. We will issue our decision within 90 days. That being our only oral argument this morning, we are adjourned.